Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The Deepwater Horizon disaster, better known as the BP oil spill disaster, has dumped between 19 million and 43 million gallons of oil into the Gulf of Mexico. Today we're going to talk about how to fix the leak, how the environment likely will respond to the leak, and how the public can help. Joining us right now is Louisiana State University Environmental Sciences Professor Emeritus Ed Overton. Ed, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Good morning.
Joining us later will be National Wildlife Federation naturalist David Mizajewski. But Ed, for now, I thought maybe we could hear from the president right now. He promises yesterday a comprehensive investigation into the causes of the Deepwater BP oil spill. Let's hear from it.
Until the well is stopped, we'll multiply our efforts to meet the growing threat and to address the widespread and unbelievably painful losses experienced by the people along the Gulf Coast. What's being threatened, what's being lost, isn't just the source of income, but a way of life. Not just fishable waters, but a national treasure.
That was the president yesterday talking about comprehensive investigation into the causes of the Deepwater BP oil spill. Ed, how separate are the investigations of what caused it, what can fix it, and what we can do in the future to avoid it?
Well, I hope they're highly separated, to tell you the truth. We need to focus all of our attentions right now on stopping the well and cleaning up the oil. There'll be plenty of time for investigating how this happened and what we can do about it in the future. But right now, we're dumping between 10,000 and 20,000 barrels of oil in the Gulf a day. And frankly, you know, the odds of these fixes are relatively small. So we've got some big problems, and I would like to see all the efforts focused on solving the current problem and deciding who is at fault. I mean, I don't think there's much question about who's at fault here. The issue is how are we going to stop the well and how are we going to clean it up and what assets can be brought in to help clean it up. I hear a lot of talk, but I'm not hearing just a lot of specifics. I'm going to do this. And frankly, I think we need to stop talking and start doing.
So far, everything's failed. The latest plan is to cut and cap process. It's to put a lid on the leaking wellhead so the oil can be siphoned off to the surface and, I guess, scooped up there. I think this is the process that was described as hitting a dinner plate with a cannonball. I think that you've said it, maybe in the New York Times article recently, that it could make a bad situation worse.
Well, I think the idea is that the damaged riser pipe, there was some flow restriction in that pipe prior to the oil entering the Gulf. And when you cut off that damaged riser, what you do is you remove that flow restriction so the actual flow of oil out of the pipe is going to be more. I've heard estimates of 20% more.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we've heard lots of estimates, and most of them have been wrong, so we have to take everything kind of with a grain of salt. But having said that, the reason you do that is that you can have a bigger gain, and that bigger gain is that the riser is now amenable to putting a snug cap over it and pumping the oil to the surface. So we all hope that this will work. But the difficulties are just mind-boggling to my way of thinking. I mean, these are 20-inch pipe, 22-inch pipe. The weight is incredible. There's a liner that's attached to the surface a mile above. There's ocean swells going up and down. There's ocean currents moving this stuff back and forth. And you've got some relatively puny little ROVs now. You know, these are not Caterpillar tractors with their wheels on the ground mm-hmm. pushing pipe around. These are basically boats that have propellers that are trying to push this pipe into place. And it just looks like it's a horrendously difficult problem. They do have absolutely the best engineers working on this, and they seem to have some confidence. I'm certainly hoping that this will work. But we need to face the fact that there's a lot of oil on the surface, and we need to try to marshal all of our resources to get that oil off the surface as much as possible before it gets onto the shoreline.
You said that they have, you know, lots of brilliant engineers working on this. Are you confident that they do know what they're doing and that this trial and error process is just inevitable given the complexity of the situation?
Well, I think that they they did not do not know exactly the situation on the bottom. For example, they didn't know how much restriction was in that that riser pipe that was that they cut off. And part of the idea of the top shot, which was the failed attempt last weekend, mm-hmm. was to pump mud in. Well, if you pump mud in, some of it's going to most of it's going to go up out the riser, and the whole idea was, but we'll pump enough mud in that a little bit will go back down the well and eventually stop the well. Well, the restriction in the riser was not enough to allow that to happen. So you're pumping well mud in at the top of this long well, and virtually all of it was going out the riser. So that told them something. So they now know that, hey, there wasn't a lot of restriction in there. They tried the junk shot, which was to put material that they could put in the blowout preventer that it would go up in the riser and hopefully would clog up the riser. And the flow restrictions in the riser just weren't enough, so that didn't work. So each time they're learning more and more about what the situation is. So and that means that the chances of success are starting to get a little better. But the next step, of course, is very risky because you whatever restriction was in that riser is gone now. It's cut off. So we're facing that full flow. It is at a much easier angle that it's basically straight up. So you've got to come straight down rather than try to work at some sort of a weird oblique angle. But so I think we are making progress, but it's still incredibly difficult to if they can't get that blowout preventer to shut, and they clearly can't. They've given up on that. Mm-hmm. Then some method of capping. There, I must get 24 ideas a day about things to try. And I'm not the one. I'm not in that decision making process. BP has a hotline. I've sent some ideas along to the one or two people at BP that I know, and they emailed me back and said send it to the hotline. They're not even in the loop. You know, the environmental people at BP that are working on this spill. So if anybody has an idea, there's a BP hotline on the BP page, and that is the appropriate place to send ideas. I mean, they're getting 20,000 ideas or something like that, and that's pretty tough to see through all of those.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Ed Overton. He's Louisiana State University Environmental Sciences mm-hmm. Professor Emeritus. We're talking about, of course, the BP oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico. Now, if you want to give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. You are welcome to. Ed, you mentioned 20,000 ideas. I don't know how many, if you said a day or what the relationship was there in terms of time, but do they even have the capability to absorb that much information from outside of what they're doing? I understand they're in a room and they seem sort of insulated.
Well, I don't know what kind of facility they have. Clearly 20,000. Now that was from the start of the spill. That's an accumulative number, but clearly that takes a pretty significant staff just to see through those ideas. And all of them are well-intentioned. Let me really make this clear. There's an incredible number of well-intentioned. Most of them are not appropriate because they don't consider some of the factors that you have to deal with at these depths and these pressures and the ability to move things around. So, but somewhere in all of those ideas, there are probably some very good ones.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's a lot of frustration that, you know, some good ideas are not being accepted, but you can't do everything. I mean, if you're going to do something, you've got to get your engineering staff together and lay the options on the table, pick your best bet, go after that, and if that doesn't work, pick your next best bet. And I am confident that they are doing that. They are running it past the Coast Guard for their approval, but every one of us is an armchair quarterback.
Mm-hmm.
Sooner or later, somebody's got to get on the field and play the game. And BP's doing that, and we better hope that they got Drew Brees playing the game, if I could get a plug-in for our New Orleans Saints.
Well, yes, you may, and I was wondering if maybe some folks, including the National Wildlife Federation, I believe, and others have said we need to change quarterbacks. We need to switch and put the control for the cure in the hands of the government instead of BP.
Well, with all due respect to mm-hmm. people that think that, there's not a person in the government that knows as much about petroleum exploration and development as the oil field people. I mean, that's not the government's business, and that is just, that may be a well-intentioned idea, but believe me, there's nobody in the government that knows how to do this better than the people in the business. Now, I don't think this is just a BP deal. I mean, Exxon has got a lot of stake in this because we're talking about the future of offshore development, mm-hmm. the American Petroleum Institute. I mean, there's any number of qualified people, and, you know, while they're not coming to me and telling me what they're doing, I know how these folks act, and they're working together. They're coming up with ideas, and if a senior vice president for Exxon calls up a senior vice president for BP and says, would you consider this, it will get considered. I mean, the petroleum industry, as well as all the support staff, it's not just the biggies, but, you know, for instance, some of the best RUVs in the world, the ones they're using, are made right here in Morgan City, Louisiana. So those people...
These RUVs are robotics.
Remotely operated vehicles.
Right.
These are the ones that are nudging it around. And there's a world-class facility where, you know, the hub of ROV activity is South Louisiana, and the reason is because these companies support this offshore oil industry. So you've got the people with the skills and the experience and the background to know how to do this. And it's in the petroleum industry. It's not in the government. I mean, I think there's mm-hmm. plenty the government can do. Don't get me wrong. I would like to see a lot more effort at getting the oil off the surface once it's up there. I was out with the Wildlife Federation last Wednesday, a week ago today, and we had to ride around a pretty good while to find the oil. But once we found the oil, we were in a patch of oil that was eminently skimmable. The weather conditions were wonderful, and there was not a skimmer or another boat from horizon to horizon. As far as you could see, there was nothing. Now, that's just unacceptable to have big patches of oil out there 10 miles offshore that was eminently skimmable. If the government wants to do something, they can look around the world and find any available skimmer, put it in the back of a C-117, fly it over here, and put it to work in the Gulf. When you do that, you've got to provide some sort of accommodations way offshore, because this is a very, very remote area. It's 50 miles from the tip of the Mississippi, which is, and that's 50 or 60 miles or so from New Orleans. So you're talking way, way out in the Gulf. Mm-hmm. So you need accommodations out there for the people, for their health and safety, to feed them and to give them a place to stay. You need the logistical support. You can't just put a skimmer out there and mm-hmm. say go to work. You've got everything to support it. But that's something that the government can do. The military is very good at that. If they know how to do anything, they can support remote operations. They are outstanding at that.
Well, I think Haiti probably is as good of an example as any.
Yep, there you go. Now, that's a place where the government could step in and really provide it. But I'm not hearing that from a suggestion. All I hear out of Washington is we're going to get to the bottom of this and find out who's at fault. That's fine. I don't have a problem with that. Not now. Let's get this oil off the surface before it causes incredible damage.
We have to take a short break. When we return, we'll continue our conversation with Ed Overton. He's Louisiana State University Environmental Sciences Professor Emeritus. We'll take those calls and emails as well. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Political junkies obsess over the intramural battles of primary season, and if you thought May was good, you're going to love June. We'll get results from Mississippi and New Mexico, and of course...
And they don't give a riff about Alabama.
Oh, but we do, especially when even the Ag Commish race has ads that good. I'm Neil Conan. Political junkie Ken Rudin joins us next Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
And Talk of the Nation begins this afternoon at 2 o'clock right here on WOSU 820 NPR News. And thanks for joining us for All Sides with Ann Fisher. It is 76 degrees in downtown Columbus at 10:20. Some sunshine today. There is a chance of showers and maybe a thunderstorm this afternoon, a high of 82. Cloudy with showers and thunderstorms likely tonight, a low of 65. And showers and thunderstorms are likely throughout the day on Thursday, a high of 80 degrees. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues. This is WOSU 820 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about the BP oil spill, the Deepwater Horizon disaster, with Ed Overton. He's a Professor Emeritus at Louisiana State University in Environmental Sciences. Before we move on from who should be running the show, Ed, I wanted to just listen to what Governor Bobby Jindal had to say.
We need more boom, more skimmers, more vacuums, more jackup barges that are still in short supply. And let's be clear. Every day that this oil sits and waits for cleanup is one more day that more of our marsh dies. We know we've got to take action. We've got to take matters into our own hands if we're going to win this fight to protect our coast.
Do you think that the state of Louisiana has the resources to do it if the federal government doesn't?
I don't know. I mean, Louisiana is just like everybody else. Their budget is incredibly tight. And this is such a massive amount of work that is required. It's kind of interesting that all of this is recoverable money, but you got to spend money to recover it. So, in other words, if you can't show after the event that you have spent this money on the spill, then you can't get it back. So you've got to spend money now, and that means, of course, states are constrained in that they have to live within their budget. They can't do like the federal government. At least I don't think Louisiana's constitution allows us to do that. So
right.
there's some real issues there. I think Governor Jindal is asking for federal help, is what I heard
right.
in what he was saying. The help we need is some specifics about how to get the oil off the surface. Remember, he said we need more skimmers and jackup barges, by the way, or just barges that are used to support the work offshore. They're a stable platform in fairly shallow water where people can be housed and you can come and refuel and all of those things. So that's what he's talking about.
Okay.
That's a device. That's part of the infrastructure. We ought to be treating this oil well offshore. We ought to be treating it near shore, and then we're going to have to treat it onshore, unfortunately. So there's three levels of protection. And those three levels need to be scaled up a lot from what they are now.
Let's take a call now. It's been out there. Veronica, you're on the air. People have been talking about what you want to talk about.
Yes, hello. Ms. Fisher?
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you, Ann. I will be very brief,
okay.
And I just I'm not extremely educated on this topic, and I do applaud that you have these wonderful, articulate guests today, and I thank you for that.
You're welcome.
Okay, so I will state my question, so to speak, and
mm-hmm.
then I will take my answer off air.
Okay.
Now, I understand from what you've already said that you are not, an expert in all areas of this. I'm not trying to, specifically ask you this, but I just wondered if you've heard of this story or possibly the National Wildlife.
Okay, well, Veronica, the other fellow isn't on yet, so why don't you just...
Okay. Well, what I'm trying to say is the other night I was listening to BBC radio broadcast. I think it was the overnight service.
Yep.
This is related to, I had heard of a theory where they are going to try to use nuclear bombs to cut off
okay.
the spill.
All right.
This was a credible source that mentioned this. And they said that it would be a quick way to handle it. It would be safe, and that it has been successfully used in Russia.
Okay.
And I just wondered if your guest had heard of this and could expand on this, if so.
Okay. Thanks,
Thank
Veronica.
Thank you very much.
You bet.
Bye.
Yes, I have heard of that. In fact, I've gotten several emails with diagrams and ideas of how it could be implemented. It's my understanding from talking to folks that are more familiar with the Russian test is that it initially worked, but that the because it just turned everything down in the bedrock to molten lava, but that it was when it cooled back down, it developed cracks in it and the oil started leaking again. So it was not a permanent solution. And in fact, on top of the continued oil leak, then you had the problems of highly radioactive material that were leaching into the environment. So I don't really see that as a solution right now. You have to, in order to do an underground nuclear detonation, you would have to drill some sort of a long shaft way down and almost intersect. Now, I know these nuclear weapons are fairly small now. You could put a tactical warhead pretty low down in the earth, but you still got to have a way to get it down there. And it's got to be far enough down that when the when it implodes, explodes, and then implodes back again, that it seals everything up. And frankly, the time it's going to take to drill the well to put the nuclear weapon down there is on the same order of time as the relief wells are longer. So I don't see that as a viable alternative right now. The risk of a nuclear detonation is very substantial. We did have a nuclear detonation in the 50s in a salt dome in southern Mississippi, and basically that salt dome is sealed up. But even today, they still have a fence around this area, and they check for radioactive leaks every year. So it's basically the Department of Energy who set off the explosion monitors on a routine basis, and nobody can use that area. And this was on land. Of course, it was in a salt dome, several hundred feet several thousand feet below the Earth's surface. But we probably should stay away from nuclear solutions if at all possible.
We have another suggestion now from Mort. You want to talk about putting NASA in charge?
That was one of the comments. Okay. First, I do have a question for our guest, and then three quick suggestions.
Okay.
One is it possible that they never did make a tabletop model or a small model and test the stratagems for these emergencies?
Clearly, the oil industry and all of us that respond to the spills, from the environmental folks like myself to the regulators to the oil industries, were caught off guard. The people have made suggestions throughout the years that we need to know more about what's going on in the deep oceans, and most of those were said, yeah, that's a good idea, but the cost of doing and understanding that is so horrendous that we just don't have it in our budget. So flimsy excuses like that, and flimsy pushing on people like myself and not demanding that we do it, are partially to blame, because we really don't know much about the environment down there. We don't have the technology. We don't even have decent technology to sample the water column at those depths, believe it or not.
And
it's just amazing, and of course, You find out you don't have the good technology, but I'm talking about for oil now. We've got technology to sample water down there, but mm-hmm. if the sample has oil in it, these sample containers get contaminated with this sticky oil, and it's just a real mess. So it's amazing how flat-footed the whole technology was from the production end of it, the exploration end of it, all the way through to the scientific end that had not done what needed to be done throughout the years.
Yeah. Well, my point was that they needed to create small models and play with them. The aircraft industry does not get an airliner off the ground before they put a model in the wind tunnel. Let me make three specific suggestions. One, there's been a big problem trying to estimate the rate of flow. Anyone familiar with medical ultrasound knows that you can get an accurate measurement of the rate of flow of blood in an artery, and if you know the cross-section of any vessel, you can tell how much is going through there in unit time. That could be applied any time if they contact any medical department of any university and get that information.
Could I come in on that, please?
Yes, please.
As I appreciate the situation down there, you've got a well casing, and then you've got a pipe that's inside that. You've got this 19-inch casing, and then you've got a 6 or 7-inch pipe where the oil is coming up.
Yes.
And they don't know absolutely what the situation is inside that blowout preventer. The blowout preventer was supposed to be actuated and cut that inside pipe off. But it could be oil flowing up around the inner pipe, what we call the well string, or in the casing. So it's a fairly complicated situation, and most of it is below ground. So you've got precious little of this sticking up where you could even get to it. So I'm not entirely sure that they could get to some of these ideas like that make perfect sense if you could get to them. But this is a horrendous spot down there, and plus you've got to have equipment that can withstand the pressure of your sensors. I mean, you know, we are trying to get, for example, ways to measure gas down at that low level, and they require having a membrane where the gas can diffuse through the, from the water into the instrument. And but those membranes have to stand a lot of pressure.
Yeah, well, they don't have to get down inside it. We see the pictures every day of the column escaping in a solid stream. They can, if they had a unit properly encased that could be possibly even inside the robot, they can point it at that and get a reading. And any kid that's taken geometry in the 10th grade can figure out the cross-section diameter and multiply it out and get a reading. Well, it's not that simple, but I think they need to look into that.
Mark, we have other people waiting, so I just want to make sure everybody gets a shot. So.
Okay, and I think they ought to put NASA to work on this.
Why?
If they can control a not only put a man on the moon, but control vehicles on the moon. And one of the things they do is to have, when there's a problem, is to have a model of the same vehicle on a tabletop so the engineers can play with it and then answer the questions that come up and then transmit it to the vehicles on the moon or Mars. I think that's the kind of talent that we need doing this.
All righty. Thank you, Mort, for your call. Appreciate it. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820. And joining us in a few minutes will be David Mizajewski of the National Wildlife Federation. Ed, are you comforted by the executive order establishing that bipartisan national commission?
I don't know too much about the executive order. What I heard, the short sound bites I heard, were we're going to get to the bottom of who could
okay, that's what,
fault. And, man, I tell you, that just really, that got all over me because, you know, we know who's at fault. That we don't need an executive commission for that. What we need is ideas and implementation right now to get the oil off the surface. And I'm not hearing government say that. All I'm hearing government do is point fingers and blame somebody else. Let's solve the problem. I'm not hearing solutions. Please give us solutions. We don't need more problems right now. We need solutions.
There's a question about whether there are large masses of oil suspended beneath the surface.
Yes.
What are your thoughts about that? That there's more coming up all the time that isn't even, you know, that's already been shot out. It just hasn't emerged.
Right. There's clearly a plume from the bottom of the ocean up to the surface. And in general, this is a very light oil, so its density is somewhere around 0.9. The density of the ocean water is somewhere around 1.03. So this oil should come up much like ice should pop to the top of water, an ice cube, if you could let it go up. So now if it gets dispersed into really, really tiny droplets, the micron-sized droplets, then those droplets will tend to kind of float wherever the dispersion occurs. So, and this oil, as it comes out, is effusing because it's got a lot of gas in it. And so there's certainly a lot of smaller droplets and some big globs that form in the plume. So there's a plume of oil. Much of it goes up fairly quickly. And some of it's going to take a lot longer because it's in these little micro droplets that are spreading around. And some of those are diffusing out. And some of them are recoalescing into larger droplets, which float up quicker. So there is a plume down there. But it's very hard to explain how oil that is as light as this is going to stay down there if the globs are big enough to be seen, for instance, on TV. Mm-hmm. You see people go down with remote cameras and they see floating globs in the water and they say, oh, that's the oil. Well, if the oil is big enough to be these quarter size or nickel-sized globs of oil, it ought to be floating. I mean, you know, you just imagine if that was an ice cube, would that ice cube be floating down in the water column, or would it come up to the top of the water column? So there's some issues here about what are we seeing, and literally we're in the middle of this. The physics says that, you know, something light has got to pop to the top. It just can't stay down in the water column. So we don't know what all we're seeing down there, and I'm a bit skeptical that a lot of what we're seeing is oil, simply because the oil is so light. I mean, it's just I cannot figure a way that we can take this oil. We've taken it in the lab and we've tried to weather it. That is, react all the light ends off to make it more liquid. And every time, all of the residue of this floats on seawater. So this is a perplexing problem. There are a lot of people out there that think they're seeing this subsurface oil, and I guess my answer is I'll believe it when somebody collects a sample of it and brings it to the lab.
Okay. Welcome to the show, David Mizajewski of the National Wildlife Federation.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Hey, Tulane University ecologist Tom Sherry said that the location of the spill couldn't be worse, period.
Yeah, I mean, any oil spill is bad, and any right. oil spill is going to be a disaster. But this BP oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico is in a really horrible spot. I mean, we're talking about, you know, an extremely productive ecosystem. We're talking about 40% of the wetlands in the continental U.S. You know, we're talking about a major fishing industry that's going to be impacted, and we're talking about a place that is now just finally recovering from Hurricane Katrina. So, you know, it really is not an ideal spot for this to be happening.
The National Wildlife Federation president and CEO, Larry Schweiger, said he fears that the Gulf is reaching a tipping point. What does he mean by that?
Well, I think he means just the fact that, you know, this oil continues to gush, you know, despite every effort. You know, it's still coming out, and you know, there's going to be a breaking point where, you know, we hit that point of no return where recovery. I mean, I think we've actually already passed the point.
I guess that's what I mean. Does the tipping point mean point of no recovery that we can never bring back what we had?
I think that we've already reached that point. Yes, and I think that and this is a tough message because we want, you know, so many people are being impacted, and they really want to help. And, you know, I don't want to give people the impression that, you know, it's completely hopeless. We should just, you know, throw the towel in, because there are things that we can be doing. But, you know, the things that we can be doing are pressuring our lawmakers to make sure that we have clean energy legislation and that we have corporate accountability so these kinds of disasters don't happen in the first place. Are we going to be able to save the oil wildlife? Maybe some of them. You know, are we going to be able to sort of suck some of this oil out of these really critically important ecosystems? Maybe some of it. Are we going to be able to help the fishing industry? Maybe to a degree, but those are not the kinds of solutions that we're really going to be able to achieve. The best thing that we can do is, again, look in the big picture, prevent these kinds of accidents from happening in the first place. You know, we need better regulation. We need better energy policy. And now is the time, you know, hopefully to rally the American people and get behind those things so, again, we don't face these, you know, these same problems that we've been having. I mean, the Exxon Valdez spill was 21 mm-hmm. years ago, and, you know, I mean, nothing's really changed. You know, we're still in the same boat as we were back then.
We will return to our discussion about the catastrophe in the Gulf of Mexico with Ed Overton of Louisiana State University. He's an environmental sciences professor emeritus there, and also David Mizajewski, who just joined us. He's with the National Wildlife Federation. We'll be right back. We'll get those calls and those emails on All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Corporate partners help provide support for WOSU 820. Your business can join them and reach an educated, engaged, appreciative audience every day. Your business will also be associated with a trusted source for national and local news, arts, and culture. For more information, contact Christine Schottich at 247-4469. And thanks for supporting WOSU 820, NPR News.
And you're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News. In 20 minutes at 11 o'clock, we'll hear about custody disputes in same-sex relationships. That discussion begins at 11 right here on WOSU 820. And remember to hear more from WOSU anytime at WOSU.org. Listen to All Sides with Ann Fisher whenever you want with the online archive. Podcast new and archived shows from all the guests and topics. Podcast All Sides at WOSU.org/All Sides. It's 76 degrees in downtown Columbus. Some sunshine today, also a chance of rain and a high of 82. Cloudy tonight with rain showers and thunderstorms likely, a low of 65 degrees. And then showers and thunderstorms throughout the day on Thursday and a high right around 80. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues. This is WOSU 820 NPR News.
Support for WOSU comes from the other paper, Columbus's News and Entertainment Weekly, on newsstands every Thursday and online at theotherpaper.com.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guests are David Mizajewski of the National Wildlife Federation and also Ed Overton. He's a professor emeritus in environmental sciences at Louisiana State University. I want to take one more call from a listener, Ed, about a question about, you know, the process of trying to fix this. Glenn, you're on the air. Thanks for joining us.
Hi. Nothing I've heard in the news has said that the original fail-safe device has been, you know, tampered with or modified since the disaster. I'm wondering if it's still intact and ready to go, that the reason it didn't engage was that there was no loss of pressure because the pipe folded instead of having a major break, and that if they cut this pipe now, there'll be a loss of pressure, and could it still work?
Well, it's my understanding that they actually tried to remotely actuate this blowout preventer right immediately after the spill, and they tried for two or three days sending the ROVs down to turn the switches that would be required to override the automatic protection, and none of that works. So for whatever reason, the blowout preventer is just inoperable right now. And
to add to that, Ed, I'm just looking at a late-breaking update here saying that they are attempting to saw through the pipes on the well, and so maybe that's what they're trying to accomplish. Of course, the news is that one of the saws that they are using is now jammed and stuck in the well, which is now halting that entire effort. So, you know, it just goes from bad to worse with this oil spill.
Yeah, it is an incredibly difficult process. They have to saw the top of the blowout preventer pipe, the riser, off so that they can put a cap on. And if they can't cut away the damaged riser, they can't put the next cap on. So this is some more bad news.
Thanks, Glenn, for your call and for the update. David, so far the oil has hit about 125 miles of Louisiana coastline. It's traveled as many as 12 miles inland. This is just according to state officials and the last that I had on it. Maybe Glenn knows more. And those numbers might be higher by now. What about the wetlands? What's the National Wildlife Federation's thoughts about how to save or the wetlands? Or should just fish, you know, fish? Should it be a fish or cut bait process at this point?
Yeah, I mean, again, once the oil gets to those wetlands, the damage is really done. You know, and so in the big picture, again, we have to prevent these things from happening.
Mm-hmm.
You know, once the oil reaches the wetland grasses and other vegetation, it coats it, eventually kills it. That vegetation is the habitat for, you know, countless species of wildlife, you know, everything from birds to invertebrates, even to, you know, some mammals. And it's also those sort of wetland estuary kind of ecosystems are where the, you know, many of the fish species are, you know, sort of live the first stage of their life, their larval stage. And
mm-hmm.
So it's just doing enormous amounts of damage. And once it gets in there, like I said, the damage is done. And, you know, here's where the chemical dispersants, you know, are sort of coming in another way as far as adding to the problem, because they've got all these booms in place, and that, you know, may or may not be effective in stopping oil that's sitting on the surface. But once you put the chemical dispersants in there and break this oil up into smaller particles that mix better with the water, well, guess what? It goes right under the booms, you know, and then has more of a chance of actually, you know, sort of maybe in a different form, but making its way to the shore. So, yeah, I mean, again, it's a pretty grim picture, and I have not been down there myself yet, but Larry Schweiger, our president, Dr. Doug Inkley, our senior scientist, have been down there, and I was talking to Doug yesterday just that you know, the fact that this oil is everywhere. You know, it's out to sea, it's in the wetlands, it's under the water in this giant plume, it's floating on the surface, and again, it continues to spill.
Is BP still ignoring that order by the EPA to end the spraying of the chemical dispersants, or has the EPA modified its order and now said try to stop it? I don't quite get that.
Yeah, you know, I'm not even sure where we are with that. I kind of lost track of it.
Yeah.
And maybe you have a better update, but I know that originally the EPA said, you know, you need to stop using this chemical dispersant because of the unknown impacts, mm-hmm. and then BP said no, and that's kind of where I lost track of it. But
and I don't know if that's
–
you
know, the dispersants are only supposed to be used well offshore, so the idea of dispersant use offshore is to minimize – onshore impact. So,
right.
And I don't believe they've been used in an area where the dispersed oil would come onshore. So, and there is a modicum of good news in that the oil that is reaching the shoreline is heavily weathered, and the heavily weathered oil is a lot less damaging. And my colleague, particularly Dr. Mendelson, says that these are pretty hardy grasses, and so, you know, they can withstand one impact. It's just this continued impact over long periods of time that will ultimately kill the root systems and cause significant damage. So, and of course, that not only is loss of habitat, as David has pointed out, but it's loss of coastline, and that
right.
opens up the habitat. So we've got a geological issue that we're
mm-hmm.
dealing with, a whole reshaping of the Louisiana coastline. If we can't stop the oil at sea, we need to stop the oil at sea, and that means getting more skimmers and more effort offshore. I would personally prefer to only use dispersants when you can't skim the oil. Increase the skimmer fleet by an order of magnitude. Get more boats and equipment out there to skim the oil. That's your first line of defense. Have
mm-hmm.
a near-shore skimming set up, and then the last line is really not much you can do once the oil hits the coastline. It's particularly in the grass. You can get oil off the beaches, but in the grasslands, it's most efforts are more intrusive than they are useful.
I would agree with that.
We have an AP report from 10:05 that says that the Coast Guard now is Coast Guard crews are shooting chemicals underwater to disperse the Gulf oil leaking out of the new cut. So there we go. That's
yeah.
the latest.
Well, I guess that's the subsurface use of the dispersants, right?
Right. It's what you
yeah.
were recommending. If you're going to use them there.
Well, what I would recommend is that we don't use
yeah.
them until we try to. Now, skimming is not 100%, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, and occasionally there's if you have skimming that is directed by aerial observations, put some blimps out there with infrared cameras, find the thick oil, and divert your skimmers to work the thick oil. Now, you leave a little bit. When you do, might use a very light spraying of dispersants on some of the oil that you can't get with skimmers. But stop this massive spraying of dispersants and just use it well offshore, not near shore, mm-hmm. 1,000 feet of water or more. I mean, I'm talking, you know, that's way off. But try to increase your skimming of this oil offshore. We're not using every skimmer in the world, and I don't see any excuse for not having skimmers. If there's skimmers in Norway, see if we can borrow those. Send the C-117, bring them up here.
Mm-hmm.
Bring the people that know how to operate them. Get people that know how to operate booms. So we put a lot of booms out there, but there was virtually no instruction on how to effectively operate the booms. Booms are trapping oil, but nobody's going in and getting the oil out of the booms. So what happens? They wash over the booms. They build up, and then the oil that's being trapped is being flushed over it. So you can't just put a boom around something. You've got to work it every day. And this is what mm-hmm. I'm talking about. There's not that level of intensity, both near shore and offshore, to respond to a spill of this magnitude.
David?
And, well, I just wanted to point out, too, that, you know, everything that Ed's saying is true. And shouldn't this be part of a reaction plan to a disaster, you know, when oil is spilling like this? And why isn't, you know, why isn't BP reacting? Why didn't they have a plan in place to get those skimmers out there and to have trained people to deal with booms and to know the impacts of the chemicals that they're dumping in unprecedented quantities into the Gulf of Mexico? You know, I mean, and this is what we're talking about. If we can't have this kind of corporate accountability for industry that has the risk of having this kind of huge negative environmental and economic impact, you know, I mean, there's just no point in having any kind of, accountability, right?
Well, this isn't the only oil. I mean, this isn't the only, this is the biggest one ever, but it's not the only one ever by a long shot. I mean, we start hearing, you know, we're getting these dribs and drabs of information about all the other ones that we don't really hear about that often.
Right.
Is that because they don't happen around the United States or as close to the United States, and so we're not aware of them, so we don't care?
Absolutely. There's a much larger one in Nigeria right now, and there was a much larger one down in Mexico in Ixtoc than this spill. And the good news is that it was most of the oil was 500 miles away before it hit the U.S. coastline. There was damage along the Mexican coastline. That was back in 79. But let me come back to something David said. There's other. It's not just BP that should have these things. The federal government is getting incredible tons of money from sale. From royalties of this oil and gas that has been produced. And that money is being taken in by the U.S. government and spread around the country for various worthy projects. If we had taken just a little bit of that money, 10% of it, and put it into the research and development that we need to support offshore oil and gas, we wouldn't be here. But we didn't do that. The royalty monies are being used for everything except what they should be used for. We're generating incredible billions of dollars a year. I don't even remember the latest number. It's $200, $300 billion. And none of that money is being plowed back to ensure the safety of the technology that is being used. This is just scandalous. It just should not happen.
We have an email from a listener right now. On today's program, you have made the point that the U.S. government agency officials cannot be expected to know as much about how to stop the oil leak as the BP officials know. When should U.S. government agency officials know as much as the oil companies? If the U.S. officials don't have as much knowledge about this as the industry officials, aren't they just, quote-unquote, rubber stamping what the industry officials come up with?
Well, I think people in MMS normally are retired employees out of the industry. But they, you know, they are like a lot of us. We're on the sidelines. We're trying to be Monday morning quarterbacks. We're not trying to be, but we're making comments.
Mm-hmm.
The oil industry knows more about this than anybody. Now, I'm not saying there shouldn't be better regulations. Don't get me wrong. And it is the right and the purview and the actual requirement that government ask tough questions about. What about this? What about? And that just was not done. There was a sense that we had engineered the technology to solve this problem. There was a sense that the Titanic had engineered solutions to solve its problem, right? An unsinkable ship. And you can just go right down the list of the solutions that the Exxon Valdez was caused by human complacency. There was a sense that they had radar. It was a beautiful. There was no excuse for the Exxon Valdez wreck, but human intervention caused that wreck. And I suspect when push comes to shove and we finally get to the bottom of this, we're going to find out that there was human intervention that caused cutting corners, whatever, which is the same thing, caused this accident.
We have a call now. It's Patty, you're on the air. I haven't heard this one before.
Good morning. I had several concerns that would be fire-related.
Let's do the one on the lightning.
Okay.
And leave it at that.
The idea of you've got all that oil out there, and I talked to the state climatologist for South Carolina. I had questions about oil coming ashore there, and I brought up this issue. And the idea of if you've got lightning strikes in the Gulf, could it catch the oil in the Gulf on fire? And her feeling was, yes, it could. And then I also, with that, asked her about the storms, the hurricanes, being able to pick up the oil where you would have oil falling as rain. If you've ever been in a hurricane and those powerful waves and wind, and if that oil would come ashore as rain, and then you've got lightning, you've got the potential of fires all over.
Sounds like Armageddon.
It's really bad, and the only way to fight such a fire, what I found, is with a slurry or a foaming agent. You have to actually smother it, which would be difficult to do if oil's dropping as rain, your roads are covered. You know, how do you send a fire truck out when their windshield would be covered? And I raised the issue in Florida, Louisiana, and the Carolinas on could they, you know, if this is possible, that they would need to, I don't know how you prepare for it, but to have the firefighting equipment. So, and in looking at the Gulf of Mexico, I've been studying all kinds of maps. There are several ammunition dumps that the U.S. has.
Okay. All right.
Let's
move. But thank you, Patty.
I mean, Patty, they're using in-situ burning out there, but you have to corral the oil into fairly thick mats before you can burn it. So there's no chance, unless a lightning would strike right at where the oil is coming out of the up to the surface where it's the most precious, then there's vapors. There's a very, very slim chance that you could cause any kind of fire there. The fire would relatively quickly be extinguished because in order for oil to burn, it has to have a thickness of a quarter of an inch or so. You've got to get it thick enough that the heat is not absorbed by the water under it. And this is a fairly well-known science about how to burn oil on water. And they've got one of the world's experts of actually doing that. A guy, Professor Al Allen, is out trying to do what's called in-situ burning and burning the oil. So I don't think we have to worry about fire offshore. They're trying to use fire, and burning is one of the cleanup tools to remove some of the oil.
David, we just have about a minute left. I wanted you to tell people, what can they do at this point to help?
Well, National Wildlife Federation has set up a website. It's nwf.org/oilspill, where, you know, we're putting up all the sort of latest news and things about what's going on. But we also, you know, want to give people some tangible things that they can do so they can participate and, you know, feel like they're making a difference. So we're setting up right now a series of opportunities in the Gulf Coast called the Gulf Surveillance Teams, where we're going to be training volunteers, people that are naturally out on the water, to help us spot oiled wildlife and report it. Mm-hmm. So you can sign up for that. And it's not off the ground yet, but it will be shortly. Okay. We've got links where you can contact your elected officials and let them know that, you know, this kind of disaster is preventable if we get clean energy and corporate responsibility. And we have a text to give program. If folks want to text the word wildlife to the number 20222, you can make a $10 donation to the work that National Wildlife Federation is doing, both in immediate response to the spill, and also we've been present on the Gulf Coast for the last 10 years working on coastal Louisiana restoration. So we've got a lot of experience in this arena, in this area, and we could use everybody's support.
Thank you, David Mizajewski of the National Wildlife Federation. Thanks for joining the show.
Thanks.
Also, Ed Overton, Professor Emeritus at Louisiana State University. Thanks, Ed, for being on the program today. Appreciate it.
That's quite all right. Thank you.
That's all the time we have on All Sides for Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, Daily Show correspondent Samantha Bee. She's reported on everything from the scourge of progressivism to press conferences where married politicians confess they've had affairs.
If there's one business event your spouse should probably be excused from, it's the one where you explain how you've betrayed them.
Samantha Bee talks about The Daily Show and her new memoir on the next Fresh Air.
And Fresh Air begins at noon right here on WOSU 820 NPR News. This is listener-supported WOSU and WOSU HD 820 Columbus, and streaming on the web at WOSU.org, WOSU 820 NPR News. When you don't have time to catch the whole story, get the update with the WOSU Daily News Loop. Receive award-winning local coverage and NPR headlines emailed every weekday right to your inbox. Catch up on current events or listen to a story you missed. Don't miss a beat with the WOSU Daily News Loop. To sign up, go to WOSU.org/email. And it's 77 degrees in downtown Columbus at 1 minute before 11 o'clock. Some sunshine today, also a chance of rain, a high of 82. Clouds tonight with showers and thunderstorms likely and a low of 65. More rain for Thursday, showers and thunderstorms throughout the day tomorrow, and a high of 80. This is WOSU 820 NPR News. Good morning. It's 11 o'clock.
Gay marriage in Ohio is out for now, but gay parenthood is very much legal in the state of Ohio. So what happens to the kids when gay and lesbian couples split? Apparently, the issues are pretty much the same as those for heterosexual couples and often boil down to the usual conflicts. And just as with straight partners, the kids' lives can be thrown into turmoil. Several such legal disputes in Ohio and the nation are testing the parental rights of people who aren't biological parents of a child but have embraced the responsibility. Hear more in a minute from lawyers on two sides of the issue, as well as a spokesperson for Stonewall Union on how the issue affects gay rights. That's next on All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.